So tonight I'd like to continue the theme of how to work with thoughts in the meditation practice. And I'd like to look at a number of different kinds of thoughts or thinking. There's a particular line in the Middle Length Discourses where the Buddha said, "A liberated one will think whatever thought he wishes to think, and he will not think any thought he does not wish to think." I find that to be very inspirational and very challenging. I don't know many of us who are there yet. Do you think only the thoughts that you want to think and not think thoughts that you don't want to think? I mean, it describes a quality of control over one's mind. That this being who has this degree of control is not seduced by any little whim that comes by, any little fantasy that arises. They're not controlled by any particular pattern or conditioning. This is describing somebody who is not the slave of their conditioning or their minds. Most of us experience something more like this other phrase that comes in the Udana, a book of utterances, inspired utterances of the Buddha, where he described not understanding thoughts, one runs back and forth with wandering mind. And that's more what most of us do. We're pushed and pulled. We run back and forth with the mind that wanders here and there. There are many kinds of thought patterns, and I know that you have been noticing them because you're very articulate in the group interviews, saying what kinds of thoughts you're noticing occurring. Some planning, some fear, some guilt, some dread, some excitement in terms of hoping something will happen, some kind of turning over, rehearsing, trying to figure out, trying to design. I mean, there's a lot of different kinds of thoughts going on. How many original thoughts did you have today? Thoughts that you had never thought before? How many important thoughts did you have today? Thoughts that were truly significant? Often there's so much repetition within our own minds that it's really quite staggering. I don't know how many times you'll watch the same movie. Sometimes we'll have a favorite movie and we'll watch it again and again and again. I haven't seen that new one that's out. What is it, Avatar? Mm-hmm. But I know somebody who's already seen it 6 times in different theaters to try and see the best theater, the one with the 3D, you know, that what's that name of that kind of theater that has the, 3D. Is it called, you call it 3D? Mm-hmm. What is it? IMAX. Yeah. What
IMAX.
IMAX theaters, yes, the IMAX theaters, yes. He says it's much better in the IMAX theaters. I haven't seen it yet, but he says, oh, don't wait for it to get out of the theaters. You have to see it in the IMAX theater. Well, you know how many theaters I have to drive past to get to the IMAX theater? You know, that's like more than an hour's drive to get to the IMAX theater in our area. So, but anyway. Even 6 times seems a little extreme, but say you even watched it twice as many times, 12 times, you get eventually tired of it. Eventually, even the best movie you would get bored with, and you would say, enough already. Why don't we say that to our thoughts? Haven't you had the same thought 6 times before that wasn't even as good as Avatar? Let alone 12 times, or 24 times, or 36 times. Okay, so you change the ending a little bit. Or you improve the character a little bit. Or you change the costume. But basically, we repeat things to ourselves over and over again. If we don't tolerate that kind of repetition in our entertainment, why do we sit and think it's entertaining for ourselves? Is it really so boring to just sit and breathe, and to just feel this moment of simplicity as it is? It's interesting that we're sometimes very disinclined or averse to or not liking just the simple quietness almost, I think, afraid that we might not exist if we don't feel something dramatic. And so we might stimulate ourselves again and again with these intense stories or these dramas or repeating things or planning things or fearing things so that we keep making sure we're here, we're here. But I think you need not worry when you sit down and just sit and breathe and allow the experience to be as it is, even if it's quiet, even if it's neutral, even if it's not the most thrilling and exciting story that you've ever experienced, to allow it to just be a genuine experience of this moment of your life can be quite transformative and profound. Surprisingly satisfying, actually. We've mentioned the Pali term papancha. In English, we translate it often as conceptual proliferation. Sometimes it's translated as diversification, but it refers to the mind that that generates many, many concepts, many, many associations based upon various, you know, you get a little stimulus, a little moment of contact, hearing something, and then the mind generates lots of thoughts upon it. Karen, would you say what the Hebrew term is for this proliferation or papancha?
We usually say papancha because there is memory. But it's kind of a sipur שאנחנו מסתברים על עצמנו. שמחה מחשבה קטנה ואז זה נבנה בפרוליפריישן. לא?
אין שום מילה לפרוליפריישן.
אין כתוב, זה העברית. השתחות קונספטואלית זה השגה.
The expressions that go along with those all said papancha to me. Yes. And the flow of the language, I have no idea what you said, but it was like, yeah, that kind of papancha, you know. So you understand papancha then, I can just use Pali. Okay, great. What about tanha? Do you know tanha? Do you know mana? Do you know diti? Okay, there are three sources from which this proliferation springs. And those sources are tanha, mana, and diti, craving, conceit, and views. And Karen, would you?
Tanha is atama, which is good. Mana is a gava or yehirut, or is a little bit of a feeling of the whole world between us and others. And diti is hashkafot.
Okay, thank you. So I want to talk just a little bit about these three roots from which this proliferation occurs. Because sometimes it can be fun to just sit, and instead of just seeing the proliferation of the mind, ask yourself, what's its root? Is it supported by craving, by wanting? Is it supported by views, opinions, beliefs? Is it supported by comparing, conceit, this construction of self? And sometimes just with those proliferating thoughts, it's interesting to just see what it's springing from, and what if you can categorize it into one of those three categories. Now sometimes I'll make little games for myself. I don't suggest that you play a lot of games in your meditation, but you probably know I've spent now about 8 years in silence, and I have figured out some ways to entertain myself. And I have three little baskets. You know, it's kind of like, you know, basketball, or like you know, one of those games where you toss something into a little. So I have my craving basket, I have my tanha, I have my mana, and I have my diti basket. And when these thoughts come, I say, oh, diti, and I toss it into that basket. And oh, mana, and I toss it into that basket. And then some of them get full really fast. And others, they, you know, take a little while before they start to overflow. But it's a way just of recognizing really quickly, oh, there's another form of proliferation, and what's its root? And then just toss it away and come back to the body and the breath. But, you know, before long, the mind thinks again. Oh, there's another one. Another craving? Fill up that basket. Okay, another craving. And then go back to the body, rather than another one, craving, craving. And then, and you start to see your patterns pretty quickly just by tossing them into those three little baskets. So craving, tanha papancha. And this basically describes the way that desire projects onto an object of experience, something that we perceive. We hear some sound, some beautiful sound, and we feel attracted to it. We want to go find the source of it. We want to go listen to it some more. We want to dwell within it, and we're pulled into it. And so we start to then not just increase our contact with it, but the sound actually came and went. But we're still thinking about the sound. We're trying to get more of it. We're associating it with other things in our life. We're just developing a lot around that experience of desiring, of liking. Maybe we've tasted something really delicious. Maybe tahina. There was that first day of the retreat where there wasn't tahina. I didn't know where I was. I thought I came to Israel. A day of a retreat with no tahina. And then we had tahina. So good. So you might taste the tahina, and then you might think, you might start to proliferate on tahina. Like, there are civilized cultures that don't have tahina. Nah, they're not really civilized. What do they know? They know nothing. And the mind starts to develop all kinds of thoughts, actually just based upon this taste, this pleasant taste. But then you might taste it, and then you might start to think, well, you know, it could be improved with just a little bit of garlic. Or maybe just a little bit of lemon. I brought some lemons from that tree at home and made a donation to the kitchen with a suggestion. And it's all just based upon some taste, some sensory experience that stimulates craving, and then a development of all sorts of thoughts around it. And you might have noticed that the simplest sensory contact can give rise to lots of different proliferating thoughts. The Buddha said, sensuality does not lie in the pleasant objects. They are only the raw materials for sensuality. Sensuality is the desire in the mind. Never mind the beautiful objects in the world, but the sage gives up the desire for them. And this is a very important teaching, because the Buddha is not saying, don't notice anything in the world. Don't notice what's pleasant. Don't notice what's unpleasant. No, that's not what the Buddha is saying. He's saying that the tanha, this desire, this sensual desire, has to do with the mind, the way that we're relating to it, the way that we're proliferating things out of contact. We can let the pleasant experiences be pleasant, and we can let the unpleasant experiences be unpleasant. But we don't have to stir it around in our minds. It's that stirring up, that proliferating, that continuing, that embellishing, that clinging that occurs, that really turns this into a suffering. Whether something's pleasant or unpleasant is just its nature. So, mana papancha is translated into English as proliferation based upon conceit. And this refers to the way that the mind identifies itself with various perceptions, experiences, or objects. And often the conceit develops through comparing better than, worse than, or equal to. Have you ranked yourself as a meditator? Have you looked around the room and thought, walked in maybe around when the bell rings, but you saw somebody already sitting just like a Buddha? And then you sit 5 minutes longer, and you get up feeling really proud of yourself because you didn't get up when the bell rang. And then you see that same person still sitting there like and you hate them. Sometimes we have this pride that rises up because we think we're better than. And then we look at somebody else and we think we're worse than. Or we feel comfortable because we've decided we're equal to. And sometimes in a democratic culture, we like to think equal is good, equal is better, but it's still conceit. We're still using a ranking process, a comparing process, to create a sense of who we are, to construct me. I'm here. This is my place. If we catch the mind engaged in lots of judging, or feel pride, or comparison, then we'll be finding this mana papancha occurring. Now, diti papancha is the proliferation of mind that springs from views, opinions, the way that we, our attitude toward experience. It doesn't have to be a full-fledged, like, conceptualized opinion about something, but it's a certain view that we've taken, and it refers to a seeing through concepts, and sometimes this makes us feel secure. Prejudices, preconceived ideas are very classic examples of seeing the world through preconceived concepts, where our proliferation and our expectations and even the very way that we experience things is mediated by our views and our opinions. Now, you may have experienced diti papancha if you have an idea about how something should be, how something should be done. You know, everybody has their way of doing things. And now we're in a community. And, you know, you're sharing the shower rooms with different people. You're sharing the dining rooms with different people. You're washing the dishes after other people. And you might watch how somebody washes their dishes. And you think, no, it shouldn't be done like that. It should be done like this. Or you might be doing a chopping job in the kitchen, chopping some carrots or something. And you think, no, the carrots shouldn't be that thick. They should be this thick. They should be done on this angle, not on that angle. And sometimes we'll have little ideas about how things should be done. You know the little toilet paper rolls? Well, in your home, do you put them with the little paper coming on the outside or the little paper coming on the inside? And does it feel weird to go to one of these bathrooms and find that somebody put it on the wrong way? You know, there are little tiny things that we end up developing. We might say it's a habit, so it just feels a little unfamiliar, but sometimes around these habits, we've actually constructed an idea that our way is actually right, it's better. And we might even have a whole argument, a rationalization, as to why it is our way is better or right. Now, I know most of you have traveled, and you know that one of the first things, if you're gonna survive even a week as a traveler, you've got to let go of some of these views and opinions, because what is true within our own cultures just simply is not the norm in other cultures. And so you learn very quickly to let some of these go in order to travel in the world. And it's part of what makes traveling fun, to realize that our way is not always the right way, and it's certainly not the only way. And sometimes we don't even notice our own view on things if we're not confronted with a culture that has a different kind of worldview. So sometimes we've taken our way as being how things actually are, and it can be quite shocking to travel someplace else where the assumptions are very different. And that's, first it can be a kind of disorienting process, but then it can be very insightful, because the mind turns and questions its own views, its own ways of doing things, its own habits, and realizes sometimes for the first time that they are indeed habits, they're not truth. Whatever form of thought is arising for you, whether it's based on craving, conceit, or views, you can look at it, particularly if it's an obsessive thought, if it's a repeating thought. These are the ones that I would suggest really asking yourself, craving, conceit, or views. Which basket does that one go in? Or which pile does it go into? Or where do you file it? I find these three categories to be great tools for the investigation, because they frame the thinking and they give me just a little clue, what to look for in this. I want to learn something about this, but I don't want to sit and think about it a long time. Oh, I just learn what its root is. Ah, yes, it's that pattern, it's that pattern, that pattern. So it gets me to see very quickly the underlying tendencies, because I usually don't have to scratch my head for a long time wondering, is that one craving? Is that one conceiving? You know, it's pretty obvious. As soon as I frame the question and I have some interest to look at it, it's pretty obvious what it is. And what that does is it just points the mind to see those underlying tendencies. It takes me right out of the story and right out of the self-construction and just points me to that very deep and underlying pattern or tendency which is fueling it, which is supporting it. The mind is very interesting, and thoughts can be very intriguing. In fact, we're usually so fascinated with our thoughts that they dominate much of our experience. They often influence our mood. Our own thoughts influence our mood more than anything that's happening in the day. Often, it's our own thoughts that limit our potential as well. But then when you look at a thought, what do you find? What is the thought? They're so powerful, but where are they located? Where do you find them? What are they? When we're exploring thoughts in the meditation practice, we gave the instruction to notice that you're thinking and perhaps even label it, oh, this is a thought, thinking, thinking, just to orient your attention, to really know that's what it is, it's a thought. But once in a while, it's worth just being curious. What's a thought? What is this experience that is affecting us so intimately? Sometimes it can be useful to break the thinking down into different categories or types of thought. And I want to, in the remainder of this talk this evening, look at a number of different kinds of thought or classifications of thought. And these will not be unfamiliar to you. Many of you have mentioned them already in the interviews. They're just all thoughts. They're different ways that the internal commentator takes a different costume, a different mask, a different appearance. You can sometimes note them as a specific thing, like the first one I'm going to talk about is planning. You can note the arising of planning as planning, planning. Or you can note it just as a thought. Or you don't even need to use the note at all. Just clearly register that you are perceiving a mental phenomenon. So I want to look first at planning as a common theme. Has anybody planned anything today? Has anybody not planned something today? I mean, sometimes we plan something really simple, like when we're going to shower. Like, how much planning does that require? You walk in, if nobody's in the shower, you shower. But sometimes we decide, I think I'm going to do it after breakfast. No, I think it'll be warmer after lunch, then I can shampoo my hair, and then I can sit out in the sun and let it dry. Oh, but then it could get windy. Then maybe I'll do it before I go to bed, because then it'll stimulate a little bit more energy, and then I'll come back into the hall and meditate. It's amazing what we can try to plan. Oh, I won't give you examples. You can come up with your own examples. Notice the silly things you plan, the really silly, the things that don't require planning. But sometimes we can even plan what's even sillier is planning the rest of our lives. Have you tried that one? And if you want to get even more silly, have you ever planned somebody else's life? Like, you know what they should do? What will make them happy? Most people don't appreciate the help you're offering when you plan them their lives. John Lennon said, "Life is what happens when you are busy making other plans." Planning is a useful skill, because sometimes we do have to organize things. This retreat would not have happened if some people weren't willing to plan it. How many years in advance is Tovana planned? I mean, I'm already scheduled for 2012. So that's 2 years in advance. So it's the planning is really quite impressive, but that's what's necessary if you're going to have teachers coming from around the world. So somebody's willing to do that. Now, each of you wouldn't have been able to be here if you didn't plan. You had to register, you had to pack, you had to come, you had to carve out the time in your life. You have to plan. I tell my meditation group at the beginning of every year when they get a new calendar, you know, I say, you must, before you put anything else in your next year's calendar, you must put your retreat time in. You take a, you know, you, well, I still use a paper calendar, so I use a pen, and I put big X's through months. So I do my retreat practice. But, you know, if you use those computer things, you can still, like, fill it in with retreat in one way or another and block out your time before everything else fills it in. I look at the planning mind, and I allow myself to plan things. I think it's a very useful skill. It's just I set a limit to how many times I will plan any particular activity. I used to be generous and give myself 5 tries. Now I go for 3. That's it. Whatever it is. If I haven't planned it in 3, I'll deal with it when the time comes. So if you find yourself planning and you think, oh, but I really need to plan this, how I'm going to do this, what I'm going to say, how what I'm going to bring, how I'll prepare, what I'll do, you know, all the things you plan. Like, look, I planned. I've got 12 pages of talk here. It's a little planned. But, you know, you just plan it and then it's done. And then it's done. So you give yourself a little chance. If you're sitting and meditating and you're planning I don't know what else there is to do here other than shower. I don't know. You'll think of something to plan, no doubt, anyways, even though there really isn't anything else to do. Okay. So, you're planning something, just let yourself plan it once, twice, 3 times, and then say no and cut it off. But you have to have a little, like, strength when you say done, finished, and mean it. Otherwise, the mind will just, like, kind of come back in. Planning can be a habit that's fueled by insecurity, a very subtle fear, because we're often afraid that we'll be unprepared, afraid that we won't know how to respond. Afraid of a future, because the future is unknown. And so we plan and we plan and we plan, trying to prepare what we will say in different scenarios, what we will do, what will happen, and how we will respond to it. But planning is not necessarily preparation. It's very often just restlessness and worry. There are some things that we plan, and you know what those are. You know, they're the practical things. There's a, I don't know how many of you have been in California in the San Francisco Bay Area. How many people have? Whoa, oh, almost half of you, my goodness. Well, you know the Bay Bridge? It's a big, long bridge. I don't know how many miles it is across the bridge, but it's a big, long bridge. But it's still just a bridge. You know, it goes from San Francisco to Berkeley or Oakland, and it's just, it's a bridge. So it's a discrete length. Guess how many people run out of gas on the Bay Bridge every year? 3,000.
Wow.
Yeah, that's the statistic. I couldn't believe it. That meant 3,000 people a year didn't plan to have enough gas to get to the other side of the bridge. That's a lot of not planning. And I don't think they were in the present moment. So there are some things that need to be planned. Fabrication and rumination is another kind of thought. This is when a stimulus occurs. We see something, we hear something, we taste something, we touch something, or often we just feel something or think something. And we make up a story about it. And then we pick up those fragments of the stimulus that came to the senses to weave all sorts of stories that are plausible, somewhat believable. We can imagine that they could actually happen. And we develop this whole tale about them. But much of it is just an extension of our assumptions. This is a very classic example of papancha. I have a student who said that she had heard a screeching from the neighbor's house. And she didn't like these neighbors to start with. You know, they didn't keep their garden trim, and they didn't wash their car, and they weren't very friendly. Kind of gruff, you know, gruff. So she heard this screeching, this screaming, and she thought that they were abusing their children. And so she called the police. And the police came, and they investigated. And they found that there was a feral cat in the backyard that was defending its territory against another feral cat who was, you know, they were fighting. And I thought this was an interesting story because there was a sound, a stimulus that came, there was a sound, but there was also this predisposition, this belief, this view that she doesn't like the people, that they're not very nice, they don't keep their garden trim, So she was already predisposed to not like them. So when there was something that was a little off, the mind immediately wove a story that was somewhat plausible, somewhat believable. They had a child, and there was some screeching, some screaming. And so she took this action to call the police. Well, now maybe if it was a friendly neighbor, or maybe if it was somebody who kept their garden trim, then she might have listened a little bit carefully and realized that there was kind of a meowing kind of sound along with the screeching, or just somehow didn't jump to the conclusion quite as quickly. I don't know what would have happened differently, but it's just an example that very often the proliferation and the stories that we weave are simply not true. And just because we think them doesn't mean that they're correct. Often what we think is not based upon the stimulus of the sound. Often it's really triggered by the thoughts and the views and the assumptions that have occurred between the stimulus of the sound and our conclusion that we've drawn. We've made a lot of little leaps, a lot of little associations, and we're often reacting more to those associations than to the original stimulus, which is part of why it's really helpful to consider these categories of craving. Because if we know what we crave, then we'll know the inclination of the stories that we weave. If we know our beliefs and our views, we'll know when they're threatened, and we'll know when they're confirmed, and we'll have a sense of the accuracy of our thoughts a little bit more. Mostly it's the inaccuracy of our thoughts. And the same with the comparing. We'll often know if what our tendency to compare is, and the stories that weave when that's threatened. Whenever we have a story that's going on in our minds, I encourage you to do use the mind to ask yourself another question. Ask, is it true? Is it true? And can you know that it's true? Often we have stories and we think they're true just because we thought them, but they're things that we cannot know to be true. Oh, somebody thinks this about me. Well, do you know what somebody thinks about you? We don't even know what we think most of the time. How can we think we know what somebody else thinks? Somebody doesn't like me. Well, do we know that to be true? Often we don't. Another kind of thought is a rehearsing in the mind. Imagining what we will do, what we will say. Has anybody planned what you were going to say in the interview groups before you went to the groups? Sometimes that sitting before going to the groups is filled with a few planning thoughts, a few rehearsing thoughts. I'll say this, and then Shiloh will say this. Then I'll say this, and then she'll say that, then I'll say this. And did I ever cooperate and say what I was planned to say? The problem with those kinds of rehearsing is that we really can't control what the other person will say, and so there's no end to it. So then we think, well, if they said this, then I would say that. And what if they said this, then I would say that. And we can go on and on that way. Sometimes we want something, we need something, we need to express something. Sometimes we need to have a very important communication with a family member or with a friend. And so we rehearse again and again and again how we will say it. But when the time comes, we often don't say anything that we had rehearsed saying. I think it is helpful to often, if we have an important conversation, to in some way prepare for it. But I'm not sure that rehearsing what we are going to say is the preparation. I think connecting with a deep intention, what we really wish to communicate, not the words that we're going to say, but the feeling, what our intention is, what the spirit of the communication is. When we're aligned with that, I think we can trust that the words will be expressed and they will come out. Daydreaming is another common kind of thought. And it can be seductive because it appears when we're daydreaming that we are in control of the story. We're in control of the narrative. We might even be completely oblivious to where we are and what's happening all around us. We may not know where we are when we're daydreaming. We might have no idea whether we're inside or outside. We might not know what country we're in. We might not know whether we're sitting or reclining. Often when we're daydreaming, we have no idea where we are. We're so entranced by the tale that we weave. Now, I used to daydream a lot when I was a child. I found school, for the most part, relatively boring. I did not find it very challenging. And so I would just daydream away, entertain myself. And then once in a while, the teacher would ask me a question, and I'd answer it, and then I'd go back to my daydream. And it was really hard for me to pay attention because I wasn't engaged. And it ended up being a very painful habit that took quite some training to train my mind out of, to train myself to be willing to just connect with experience and not just seek this kind of daydreaming-like entertainment. There can be something deceptively pleasant about living in our fictions, because there we can play the hero or the heroine, or we can play the victim, or we can play the innocent bystander. We can be the narrator. We can write the script. We can direct the scene. We can change the ending. We can design the scenery and the costumes. And we can even make the musical selection. We can construct our whole experience and fill it out however we wish. But as we're doing that and we're living in a daydream, we are lost and separated from what's really real in the world. And even though it feels like we're in control, what are we in control of? Absolutely nothing. We're totally lost, and we've disempowered ourselves from the ability to make any real change in how we experience life. Sometimes we can see this daydreaming tendency most strongly in the meditation, because there's very little going on when we're meditating. We're just sitting here breathing, and we're intentionally not stimulating you with song and dance and things to entertain you. So you're just sitting there, and you have to see the patterns of mind. There's nothing else to look at here. Well, your eyes are closed. So there's really nothing else to experience. So it forces us to sit down and be with our own minds. Sometimes we'll have a little stimulus of something. Oh, imagine you're taking a hike, you're taking a walk. You're walking along a hill, and you sit down on a cliff, and you see this beautiful ridge on the other side, and you think, oh, what a perfect place that would be to build a house. And you're just sitting there, and you're imagining the little house that you've built, the little log cabin with the little fireplace and the wood-burning stove and the soups that you would cook on the wood-burning stove and the garden and how you would make it a permaculture garden and how you'd terrace the little hill and what you would grow out there. Maybe you'd put a goat or a little cow or something. I don't know what, dog or cat, or maybe there'd be a bird flying over and you'd decide, oh, I think I'll put a bird bath there. no, shouldn't do the green raccoons. And start planning, your little daydream. And you experience the daydream of this little house. And then you decide, well, a house isn't really right unless there's a person to share it with. So you think about the perfect relationship. Then you imagine, well, okay, maybe a little child, too. And then you imagine a little child. 1 year old, 2 years old, boring. Okay, so we'll skip up to 8 years old. Then there's a birthday. Have an 8th year birthday party. Chocolate cake with raspberry frosting and a little bit of sprinkles. And the mind can just plan all these things. And you're really just sitting on a cliff looking at a ridge with a bird flying over it. But the mind has gone so far into these imagining, daydreaming kinds of things that you're looking at a cake. It's like the mind feels like it's looking at the birthday cake. But you're really just sitting there on the cliff. And it's important to sometimes catch yourself with a sense of humor when you really get off like this. But we do it all the time, daydreaming. Why are we lost? Why are we lost? Why not just come into the body sitting and breathing? What's so awful about that? It's amazing how much resistance we have to being with the simple fact of just being alive. So judging, ranking, and assessing are the next kind of thought. Now, this is a very common one. In fact, many cultures rank and assess people just based upon the name. There are many cultures where you know somebody's name, and you know their caste, you know their clan, you know their social hierarchy, you know their religion, you know all sorts of things about the person, and you size them up really, really quick. And not only are you sizing up the other person, but you're sizing up your relationship to the other person. My brother lives in Japan, and Japan has a very formal culture to it. It's completely confusing to me. But fortunately, the Japanese are very understanding of Westerners who cannot possibly comprehend their social hierarchies. And so it's good enough to just bow. You just bow. But they're very careful about their social hierarchies and how much they bow, depending on who they're bowing to. So if you overbow and they're higher, then that's okay. If you underbow, they have to bow more, and then you start doing these bowing, and then these bowing, and it's like, it can be very confusing. But fortunately, they're very sweet to foreigners, and they just appreciate that there was an attempt. But they understand within their culture where a hierarchy falls, and it includes all kinds of things. It a lot, of course, has to do with age and social position and rank and job, but there are other factors as well. Male, female, all kinds of things get put into this mixture to rank one socially. I found it interesting visiting my brother. Everybody asked me if I had a business card, because when they greet each other, they give their business cards, which is actually a very sweet custom. It's very nice because the name is written down, and some of those names are hard to, some of them are kind of long, and so if they say them really fast, it's nice to have them written down. The problem, of course, was written that they were usually written in Japanese, but still. Among meditators, we often compare ourselves by how we sit, or we listen to the questions and answers and we think, oh, that was such an articulate, beautiful question. I'll never be able to ask a question as beautiful as that. They're so wise, and we elevate that person. And then another day they ask a really simple question, and then we think, that was such a simple question. I figured that one out a couple of days ago. They're not so wise. I'm feeling very wise. I got over that one already. And then, so we rank ourselves in these various ways. We all want to be wise. But wise, wisdom is not a state. It's a dynamic encounter. It's a dynamic experience. It's very interesting to teach the Dhamma. Christopher Titmus asked me to teach the Dhamma back in 1996. And I didn't think when I answered him, because I had been in living in India and Asia for too long, and I was just used to when my teacher asks me to do something, I just do it. So I didn't think. He asked me to start to teach, and so I said, okay. And I didn't realize that I would be expected to be wise all the time. And nobody is wise all the time. We're really not. We're just kind of struggling along, just like everybody else, sitting with our hindrances, working on all the same things, all the same things. Most of the teachers have a few more years of working on them than people who are newer to practice. That's why we're trying to teach. But we're still working on all the same things. You know, we're still struggling with a mind that experiences these same roots of papancha. And the ideal that sometimes we like to have a teacher have an ideal of wisdom can be very disappointing when you see just how real a teacher really is and how fallible and how human and the mistakes and the growth that we still have and still are engaged in. Wisdom is very situational. It's relative. It's specific to certain conditions. And there are certain things that somebody will just bring a great deal of clarity and insight to. But there might be another situation altogether where that person who was so clear about one thing will be pretty clueless about another. And so in some ways, we it's quite lovely because in a way we're each experts in some aspects of things. We don't all wisdom, we don't all have the same knowledge. And so we learn a lot from each other, which is part of what's so rich about a community. Of people who practice together is the possibility of really learning from each other. I have some Dharma study groups where we're reading, we've been meeting for several years now, and each year we take discourses of the Buddha. So this year we're reading the Sutta Nipata. So I've got 30 people who are reading the Sutta Nipata this year. And in the previous 3 years, it took us 3 years to get through the middle-length discourses, but 30 people got through it. It was pretty great. And we finished the middle-length discourses last year. And so the people are getting very comfortable with the discourses. And what's so lovely about those groups is that everybody contributes. And sometimes people ask the questions, and sometimes people provide some insightful answers, and sometimes people just share a story that it made them think about in their life or some way of inquiring into the confusion in their own life because of some little thing that they read about that the Buddha said 2,600 years ago. And it can be very insightful, and I found doing these study groups that even though I've read the discourses over and over and over again, there every single time I go to those study groups, I learn something new that I didn't know before. Because of something that somebody said, even though they may have been reading the discourse for the first time, they brought fresh eyes to it. And they're very exciting to have these kinds of study groups where we come together just as a community to discuss and learn rather than I go as a teacher to pontificate. Well, I kind of do that habitually, but they tolerate me. So fixing is another kind of thought. I don't know if you've tried to fix anything here. Problem solving? Maybe there's a problem in your life that you're trying to fix. I know a few of you are because you've brought them up in discussion groups. I have this problem at home. How is meditation going to solve it or fix it? Sometimes we try to fix things in the community by making a rule about it or having a policy about it or trying to control it. Now, I've had some students who like to write lots of little notes to the, not on this retreat. I haven't actually asked the managers how many notes they've been getting. But sometimes at home, you know, I'll have one or two people who are a little too helpful with their creative thoughts of how to solve every problem. And I tell them, you only get 3 notes to the staff for the whole retreat. Only 3 notes, only 3 helpful suggestions. So you don't get to suggest anything more than that. So then they have to be mindful of how many things they're going to suggest. Like, are they going to suggest that the windows be open or closed, the curtains this way or that, that we're sitting this way or that way, that the teacher do this or that, or that the staff do this or that, or that the bell would be rung this way or that way, or louder or softer, or nearer or farther. Sometimes we just are always trying to adjust the external. So if you find yourself writing an awful lot of notes that are making very helpful suggestions, which you're sure will improve the retreat for everyone, they might be really good suggestions. Just limit yourself to however many. Is 3 too many? Yossi, how many would you say? Okay. Okay.
One,
okay. Not even one. Not even one, okay. Save them to the end of the retreat. The idea is, the impulse underneath it is often this, if only I had this, then I would be happy. If only such and such would happen, then things would go well, then things would be right. If only we did this, then I would be enlightened. It's very similar to this kind of fixing and planning is what I call the designer's mind. And I've had students design all sorts of things in meditation. I had one student design this meditation bench, and he decided that his bicycle at home was really comfortable, the seat on his bicycle. So he was fantasizing about fixing this bench because he didn't like these things. They were too hard, and he didn't like those zafus because they just didn't work for him. He didn't want to sit in a chair. And so his mind, you know, started to think, you know, smart guy, you know, he designs things. Okay, so anyway, so he started designing and designing and designing and designing, and he ended up constructing this thing, and yeah, he'd slip out a little paper when I wasn't looking, and he'd draw a little sketch. And he went home after the retreat, and he built these sitting devices, and he was going to market them. I suggested that he try it for 6 months before he marketed them. Some things are great ideas, but are not really so practical. Anyway, so it included a bicycle seat and then one stand and then a little post at the bottom, and so that he could put his legs wide or narrow. They were really unstable and really uncomfortable. But he was so pleased with his design that he really used it for quite a while until he also decided that they weren't really such a great idea. But sometimes we'll plan an awful lot of things, designing things, when we can really simply let it go and just know this is the planning mind. And there's this seed of dissatisfaction underneath it. It's just another way of entertaining ourselves. So instructing is the next kind of thought that I want to mention. And this is the professor's habit. You know, it's the, I think in the questions and answers period, there was a question about guiding our own meditation. Now, sometimes this can be very helpful because our own advice is sometimes good. You know, sometimes we'll remind ourselves of good things. But if you find yourself guiding your whole meditation all the time, telling yourself what to be observing, telling yourself what you're experiencing, telling yourself what the meditation is like, then even though there's some good intentions to keep yourself meditating and to keep yourself kind of on track and on target, it might be a little bit too much. So once in a while, you know, if you hear some good internal advice, great, you know, come back to the breath. It's great advice. Come back to the body. Open. What's actually happening now? Once in a while, some guidance is really helpful. But if we're just controlling ourselves again and again, we might want to let that internal professor quiet down a bit. Thinking is not bad. Actually, sometimes it's fun. Sometimes we're funny. Sometimes we're logical. Sometimes we're creative, and it's the nature of mind to think. The problem is sometimes we just think and think and think and think and think, and we don't know that we can also stop that habitual process. When these thoughts are fueled by the underlying tendencies of craving, conceit, and views, then that proliferation often goes out of control, and it goes in directions that take us into unwholesome and harmful patterns. One teacher was asked, how would you describe the state of the world today? And he said, lost in thought. In meditation, we have to confront ourselves when we are lost in thought and train our attention to be mindful of the thinking process itself, to know this energy that just arises and passes. It's just an electrical charge in the brain. We don't have to believe the story. They're not so solid. They're not so permanent. They're not so strong as sometimes we make our thoughts into. We can cultivate wholesome thoughts. We can cultivate wholesome intentions and wholesome mental practices. Thoughts like thoughts of kindness and compassion, the decision to let go, the intention to be present, these are thoughts that are very supportive and helpful in our practice. So we're not trying to create a thought-free state. We're abandoning the unwholesome thoughts and providing the space for helpful thoughts, skillful thoughts to be nurtured and grow. Sometimes we have a lot of thoughts just because we're afraid of the quiet. We're afraid we might vanish or disappear or not even be found in the silence. And so we use thoughts to just keep pumping up a sense of self. And the content of the thoughts doesn't even matter. Look at how many thoughts you have, how many of them are about yourself. Are they thoughts that empower you or disempower you? Are they self-destructive and diminishing thoughts about your failures and your limitations, your fears and your regrets? Or are they thoughts that keep you directed along the course of what you most deeply value? Thoughts that keep you developing mindfulness, that keep you developing compassion, that really trust in your capacity to grow. All thoughts are just occurring in our own minds. It's important to see what it is they're creating and what it is they're sustaining, because very often what they're sustaining is simply a sense of ourselves. And if we limit ourselves to some concept that is imaginable, plannable, and thinkable and rehearsable, if we limit ourselves to thoughts that proliferate out of views, conceit, and craving, then we have constructed a very fixed notion of what the self is. There are states in which thoughts do not dominate the mind. And they're states of extraordinary happiness and peace. They're states of deep concentration, quiet, and insight. The jhana practice in particular provides a very systematic training to enter into these states of thought-free happiness. But we don't live in a thought-free state. We instead use thoughts with wisdom in our lives so that we are not controlled by them. I began with this talk with a reference to a discourse where the Buddha said, a liberated one will think whatever thought she wishes to think, and she will not think any thought that she does not wish to think. This is possible. At least I believe it is so. But I think we have to each find out for ourselves if we're going to live controlled by the habitual trains of thought, or if we can think whatever thoughts we want to think. In any case, there are going to be times when the mind will need to rest, when it will be tired of thinking. Is your mind tired of thinking? Do you feel weary sometimes just from the relentlessness of one thought after another after another? I'd like to end with a poem by Nyoshal Ken Rinpoche. He said, "Rest in natural great peace, this exhausted mind, beaten helpless by karma and neurotic thought, like the relentless fury of the pounding waves in the infinite ocean of samsara." Let's have a moment or two of silence. Rest in natural great peace, this exhausted mind, beaten helpless by karma and neurotic thought, like the relentless fury of the pounding waves in the infinite ocean.